I don't have an affirmative. If I can't confirm either yes or no at this point, but I am talking to them about that supplemental. I don't think there's been any action taken that I'm aware of on it.
Well, and I don't mean to badger you about it, but it's, you know, if the administration is supporting $60,000 and fully funding that $60,000, then you have to also ask for the money. So I'm just curious as to how, in what form are you going to ask for that money? And if you don't, it has to be read as less than enthusiastic support for fully funding.
Yes, sir, I understand that. And again, we our intent initially was to fully fund the $60,000 unit value, and developing the budget, we put an additional $10 million in what we anticipated the increase to be, and we're supportive. As I said, I'm working with OMB on that, and I've given them the numbers, and the board has the intent of fully supporting $60,000, so we're working toward that.
Okay, thank you, Pastor.
I think that it will be appropriate to ask you to come back at a little later time and tell us about the direction where you're taking the department, and would like to have at that time some detail on the 2000 project. But I wonder if you could just tell us briefly, is what outcomes do you expect from that? Do you expect a new foundation formula, a new proposal for funding of construction, a new approach, say in how we test kids and all the rest? Just what are your outcomes that you expect from that 2000?
Thank you. Madam Chairman, what we expect from Alaska 2000 is a complete review of our educational program. In some cases, I do expect to see some significant changes. We have a group that's addressing, we have 10 groups who are addressing virtually the entire public education system. Some of them are looking specifically at finance, others are specifically at facilities, some are looking at workforce, quality of workforce issues, preschool education, laws and regulations, how they impact the education system, choice and incentive programs, technology in education are examples of what they're addressing. What I hope to accomplish, or hope to see this process accomplish, is a complete review and some changes that would come from the committees, some recommended changes coming from the committees back to the department, so that we in turn could translate those into changes in statute that we would introduce to the legislature and changes in regulations. I have no specific goal in mind as to the type of a foundation program we should have, or the type or the specifics of our state CIP process for schools, or anything, frankly. What I'm counting on is I'm counting on the participants to advance causes that represent the needs of our state.
Are you bringing in community and regional affairs, Head Start people, and the University of Alaska and their teaching, and also coordination on curriculum? Is that sort of thing? Are you really looking at the whole thing, or are you just looking at your department?
Madam Chairman, we do have people from Head Start working with us on this. We do have people from the university system. And we're looking at, as far as teacher training, the whole gamut of things. We have many teachers involved. We have administrators. We have people from the university. And
I attended a teacher group, and they said they had 5 out of 100, and they figured that was probably 50% of the input. What's your timeline?
Our timeline for the committee process is the 19th of May will be the conclusion of the last meeting. Recommendations from each committee will be made back to the state board by June, and they must be made in priority order. As far as workforce people involved in it, I don't know exactly how many educators we have. We do have a number of teachers, and some groups are heavily built with teachers and principal participation. Those groups, Madam Chairman, are groups that are addressing the questions of how do we make the changes.
Mm-hmm.
The groups that are addressing the issues of what should this public system be doing are comprised with a majority of people who are not educators of any sort, who are business people, board members, agency people, other folks. Because I think that the questions of what should the system be doing are really questions for the public to address mostly.
I've had several requests, as I indicated to you earlier, for some of my fellow legislators that would like to give input to it. So if you could give us the chairs of the various committees, as well as, I believe you're overall chair, are you?
Well, I have four people chairing it.
Four people, yeah.
I'm getting it up.
Maybe it's appropriate that they would know who those, although that's been out, if I could just have, you know, names and addresses, and I'll send a memo to everybody just in case they want to put in, because there's been a lot of interest on the part of the individual legislators, and I think it would be good if they could get things directly into the program.
I'd be happy to do that.
Fine, thank you. Are there other questions of the commissioner at this time? Fine, thank you very much for coming over, Jerry. Nels, were you going to speak on the issue of the single site?
Madam Chair, I'd like to have Dr. Nat Cole join me here.
All right, fine. If you would both come forward and identify yourself and then give your testimony. We did hand out yesterday some information on the single site, and there's more backup if there are additional questions as we go along. So identify yourself, please, Nils.
Can we turn these things on here?
No, we're not on teleconference.
Madam Chairman, my name is Nils Anderson. I'm from Dillingham. I lobby for the single site schools and for the Lower Kuskokwim School District. And I'd like to just make a few brief comments,
yes,
and then have Dr. Cole go into the details of our just a few words on the bills. We, Lower Kuskokwim School District Single Sites, supports early funding and the $63,000. We're hoping it could be higher, of course. We all would like to see that higher, but do appreciate the fact that the legislature is considering a higher figure than the $60,000 that the administration seems to be advocating. As you also know, the single site question has been before the legislature for many years. You folks have been appropriating additional funds to take care of a problem that occurred in the revision of Title 13, Chapter 17 of the Public School Foundation program. And Dr. Cole was one of the principals involved in that revision, and I've asked him to join me here as a consultant to walk through that process with you.
Very good, Nels. Thank you. Nat.
Good morning. I'm Nat Cole. I work as a consultant to the single site school districts. I also work as a consultant to the department and anybody else, I guess, that wants to hire me. The one point I'd like to make is that I am not consulting as the lobbyist, and therefore I wouldn't really be in a position to issue a thought about what ought to be or ought not to be, but I have done the technical work, and I certainly will back up that work and answer any questions that might be related to it. If you have this little piece of paper here, which starts out with small single-site school district funding, very briefly, what I did was go back to the year 86.
Excuse me, let's be sure we have that. We always get a lot. We have statement on single site community school districts and funding.
I don't know.
This says small single site school district.
Yeah, sure. He passed those out yesterday, and I've read everything but that.
Is that the same one?
Yeah. No.
No, there is a difference. The statement deals with the actual report.
Well,
you had those out yesterday.
Yeah, that's
deals with the general analysis. You're to copy somebody from now. I don't really need it. I'm not going to, by any means, try to go through all of the details of that piece of paper. So all I'm going to say to you is that what I did is start and look at the situation in 86. And the reason that I did that is that 86 has been the best funding year for public elementary and secondary education that we have had in this state, at least from the state perspective. It may not have been the highest per pupil expenditure. I think we may have exceeded that at this point, but certainly was the highest state support. Thought being on that is that in 86, if a district really thought they needed a program, they probably had it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I use that as a base year. I then compared changes that we made Subsequent changes were made in 87 because there was an interim year change in the foundation program. Then in 88, there was a rather sizable change made in the foundation program, and it did attempt to correct certain things that were perceived as problems before that, and to some extent, there was an intent to reduce the amount of money in certain school districts, some of which were the small, single-site school districts. At the time the bill was passed in 88, I think if you look at legislative history, you would see that none of us, including legislators, were sure of what applied to the small, single-site district should be. I had made, in some cases, some rather massive reductions to them. I personally didn't know, and my feeling at that point was, we're going to have to see what history tells us. If a few years down the road, we see them cutting their staffing considerably, we see their fund balances going away, we see them going back to their own taxpayers, to their locals for more money, then we can say maybe we should take a look at it. And essentially I've done that. I've looked at it as the FY90 audited data and the 91 foundation information, but not 91 mm-hmm. audited data. Essentially I looked at those impacts of the changes that were made, those that were made intentionally. I adjusted for those that grew out of changes that occurred over the years. I adjusted for and then compared these small single-site school districts or single-funding community school districts in groupings of 1 to 250, 251 to 525, 525 to 1,000, and then combined all of the other districts to see how the impact was on each of these subgroups and on then the other group which represents the rest of the district, mobile sites primarily, but some of them are large single sites. Essentially what I found was, after making the adjustments that I felt necessary, which I've briefly outlined in that report that was passed out there, I found that the smallest of that size grouping, the 1 to 250, probably have suffered at about a 12% greater loss in terms of student availability of funds. Now, and that means that I have also looked at local, not just state money. Student availability at about a 12% level. The second group, the 251 to 525, runs about an 8% level. The 525 on 526 to 1,000, about a 6% level. I did find that the actual numbers in the 525 to 1,000 did not run up to quite 6%. But when I looked at the percentage of reduction in teacher pupil or increase, which would be reduction in teachers, but increase in pupil teacher ratio, I found that group had been hit considerably harder than the 251 to 525, and less than, of course, the 1 to 250 something. But you have to understand that on a percentage basis, if you take one person out of a real small school, you take a big percentage. And so I'm not so concerned about the percentage on the lower, smallest size group, but I am concerned about the 525 to 1,000, and that it appears to me they may have cut themselves back, and they may have been forced to cut themselves back to a level that might be detrimental to the educational program. And so for that reason, I suggested that they might not run with the roughly 4.5% that it computed to, but up to 6 as a result of just simply over adjusting. I think I'd stop with that.
Okay, you have then applied that factor of either 12, 8, or 6 to the school, and that's how you arrived at your figure.
That's correct. With the estimated 93 ADM, which considerably higher than 91.
All right. Every year, as you say, we've gone through and we've attempted to struggle with this, and we have had last year, but it's no longer in the authorization bill, an attempt to, quote, fix the formula. Is the formula amenable to adjustment Or do you feel that we're going to have to start all over again? Because what you're talking about here is another fix. It isn't, I mean, we have an appropriation bill. We do not have, you know, we're not.
That is correct. And as a matter of fact, I do have a suggestion in our part fix in the statute. So that's, you know, one of the conclusions and recommendations is as far as fixing the statute, it would indeed establish it, and then each year it would be scraped in by the department in terms of all of the total cost.
But this doesn't take into any consideration, particularly on the smaller schools, of the at least the governor's stated plan of wanting to see more boarding schools and some different. It's a status quo bill that would maintain what's going on with the current numbers of schools and the same delivery.
It assumes that education will go on next year, 93, the same way it's gone on 85 to 90 or whatever.
We've noted that Senator Hoffman has joined us this morning. Welcome back from Westward, I assume.
I was at a closer breakfast with students this morning.
You don't have to explain. That's nice. Are there questions of Dr. Cole or Nels, please?
Madam Chairman?
I would point out to the committee that the amendment was prepared by Nels and Ms. Cooksey as an amendment to Senate Bill 20, which would amend Senator Fisher's bill to carry out the formulas as proposed. Now,
Madam Chairman, just very briefly, there are two things that have been brought to our attention, at least from on the other body's side. There was a study just recently completed by ICER, and in that ICER report, they had made a statement that small schools did not deserve a significant increase in funding. And we wanted to address that very briefly, Madam Chair. And also, there was a statement made that forestry service receipts may have a bearing on additional funding for those communities that do receive it. We'd like to just address those two issues very briefly. We asked Dr. Cole to make some statements about those two issues.
All right. Just for, if you could bring out a little bit of history on that, too. Are we speaking about the adjustment that we had last year that allowed for forest receipts to be distributed to unorganized boroughs, and is that what we're talking about here?
Yes, that is.
That is correct. And essentially it seems the question is, does that really solve the problem? Does that solve the state's responsibility as it relates to these single-site school districts, or for that matter, any school district? Historically and legally, those receipts are local receipts. And I think that, you know, that is just a fact of life. And while they may give some relief to the local school district, it's equally likely they'll give relief to local taxpayers. And so some of the small single-site districts are concerned. They would like to have them classified as something other than local receipts, so they could still say to the locals, you have to come up with 4 mils out of your tax. I can't. You know, there's nothing that I see technically or legally that says that there's any reason they can't use those receipts as local and use them as if they were, you know, local tax dollars.
I will only say for you that the case was made, we need the dollars for schools. It was made very strongly, and many of those do not provide any services other than schools. So,
that is correct.
Yeah.
And all I'm saying is that it may be a blessing, it may not be.
Yeah.
And I think if you look at historically, and you do have that information, you can look at it at your leisure. Historically, those Forest Service receipts have run to down into under 200,000 on up to 6-7 million. We're in the 6-7 million now. We could easily fall back to the 200,000. So it's not a guaranteed or something that mm-hmm. we can really depend on. So I would hasten to add that too. That's basically the seems to be the issue with the Forest Service receipts. Some perception there seems to be that solves the single dual site problem, and I think I would say that, in my opinion, it didn't really solve the problem. The other issue, which seems to have come up as a result of the ICER study, which took a look basically at the last 20 years of funding of education in the state, and I might say, first of all of the educational data practically all, if not all, of the educational data they work from was provided by me. So if there are some inherent really bad problems with this report, it might be related to the data, and I might have to share that. And so I'm not here to tell you the report's a bad report. Basically, I've read it, and it, in general, I agree with the report. What I think has happened is that there were a couple statements made in the report relative to small schools. And the analysis and the findings, I have no quarrel with, but I think the interpretation that's being placed on those findings may be misplaced. Essentially what they did is they said we've taken two approaches to looking at the problem of small schools and the cost of small schools. One approach was to take a look at small schools in the Kenai School District and in the Matsu Borough School District. And they said essentially, let's take the schools, and they broke them fortunately into about the same categories of small school sites have been broken into from my analysis. And what's the, that's this little two-pager here that we're looking at. And on the table there, table A, they simply said there's a gap between the amount of money that's provided by the foundation program and the amount of money that's expended in these districts. And column D of table A shows that amount of money for the single site districts as well, and what their gap looked like. Column E shows the gap that they found in the ICER report in Matsu, and column F in Kenai. And the point that I'm trying to get to here is that there is the same gap in the single dual site funding between state foundation and total expenditures. And it's equal to or great, is as great or greater than that in Matsu and Kenai. If you'll notice, Kenai is less than Matsu, and there's a reason for that. And that reason in Matsu is being addressed, I believe, in one of the supplementals, in that one of the supplementals carries a section which would appropriate around $1.8 million, $1.9 million to Matsu for separate counts. Separate funding community count for seven different schools. The reason Kenai is closer in state funds to expenditures than Matsu is that Kenai has already had those schools that were compared counted as separate funding communities. When Matsu gets that money, their numbers will look like Kenai's numbers. And the next point I'm making, I guess, is that if that is true of schools in Matsu and Kenai with that kind of size structure, it is equally true with a single site district. The difference is the department has the ability to give Matsu a fix, and they had already given Kenai in a sense a fix, by saying you may count those as separate funding communities. The single duals are already counted that way. There's nothing the department can do for them. So I have suggested that problem probably does come back to the legislature. If you want to look at a long-term fix, then it would have to take the form of changing the foundation in a minor way. The one-year fix is the supplemental that you're talking about.
Okay. So your feeling is, when you look at the whole spectrum out there, that if there were, and we can't do it in this legislation, if we were to make the adjustment as you're suggesting to the foundation, that with the flexibility that the department already has, or do we need a change in a specific change in the foundation to put into law what's actually happening in Kenai and Matsu?
That actually is within the authority of the department. If I understand it correctly, and I believe I'm absolutely correct on this, they have granted those seven sites as separate funding communities to Matsu. If the supplemental is not passed, what will happen is that whatever money is available, Matsu's entitlement will still go up by $1.8 million, $1.9 million, and whatever the proration is, that will then just be brought down across the whole state.
So you see this as the major thing too, that needs to be fixed in the formula then?
Yes, sir. Issue.
Are there further questions of Dr. Cole?
Madam Chairman, just kind of a, you heard testimony earlier from the commissioner that the governor, of course, doesn't support 63. He supports 60. The bill is for 63, so that's a 5% increase for everybody. Also, the single school sites that were listed in the amendment that we have before us now is an additional 10% for those single school sites. And yet, why do you want to eke out another little percent? In other words, you can keep this thing going to the point where it's going to be perceived as kind of a Christmas tree, and you may lose the support of the people that are supporting the $63,000. You see what I'm saying? It just seems like, and I just look at Galena, and I don't know who represents Galena, but the bill says $150,000. This one says, oh, we want $6,000 more yet. You know, the amendment is sitting on the desk, and you know, you wonder, geez, where's the thing going to really end? Because I'll tell you, 63s, there's a lot of soul searching done by legislators to even come up with that, knowing that we're going to have to take it from somewhere else. I thought everybody would have been happy with the single school site, but apparently there's a feeling maybe we can still get a little bit more out of it.
No, I wouldn't couch it exactly in those terms. Technically, when you raise the foundation units, you raise everybody. The single dual sites are saying that compared to everybody else, we're behind now. When you raise us $3,000, we're behind exactly where we were before, unless you fix the problem that got us to where we are. And I think that's a legitimate argument. Is that yes? If you want to put 3,000 more in, put 6. I mean, you probably can justify 6, in the sense that there's been no changes since '88. But the argument that the single dual or the single site people make, and not the single site, is that that only leaves us where we were before, because everybody got an increased fix of 3,000, just like we're getting. And that wasn't the problem. The problem was we really were cut to it to begin with. Well, my data would indicate they probably are suffering more than the other school districts. But, you know, my data also indicates that every district in the state's in worse shape than it was now, and that those who are not quite as bad in shape as others have had the tax base from which they increased, and Kenai happens to be one of them, that they have actually just gone in and taken care of the increased needs out of local effort.
Right, and Kenai is at the point where we're being told that even though the people are willing to give more and tax themselves more, they can't, so they kind of feel shortchanged. But do you remember a study done by Budget and Audit 4 years ago, where they took the market basket approach? I think McDowell did one.
That was another hat I've worn, yes.
Okay, but those results came in, and it showed, believe it or not, the Kenai, I'm just going to, because you use Kenai in your comparisons, should be getting approximately 1% more. In other words, at one point, it's for Kenai, Anchorage, I don't know who else is on that thing, that Kenai should be getting one more. So the people doing the study said, well, what's the percent? We'll just round it out and keep it the same. Well, to the Kenai, you know, if it's 0.75%, that's not too bad. It's a little bit more money. And so we let that all slip by because, well, there was another district somewhere on the list that was getting less, and at that time, the political powers to be thought that, well, God, we don't want my district and my this school, my district getting less. So the whole thing was shelved.
That's correct.
So that was an inequity, and I think you're pointing out some here. And I guess I'd hate to see my insurance thing get into a thing where now somebody comes in and a couple other people come in and say, but, you know, we can show that we should get more beyond this one yet. Also, we were talking single sites. Rome, Petersburg, and ADAC, are they dual sites? I mean, how do they all of a sudden
ADAC
show up?
ADAC is a single funding community school.
Okay, why then? Okay, how about Nome?
Nome is also.
And Petersburg is also?
Petersburg.
Okay.
Those are into the numbers because primarily they have been in and out depending on whichever year since '88. Last year there was a supplemental that covered all of the single site districts, including REAAs, and what happens, the governor vetoed out everything but Petersburg and Wrangell, and I guess that was adding Petersburg and Wrangell back to the city school district, single site district, that was in the appropriation for the current year. And so those people joined the consortium, so to speak, and yes, I've analyzed them for that reason.
And there are two other questions. In other words, if you didn't join the consortium, you're still on this list.
Oh, yes.
Okay.
But I don't know that anybody on that list isn't in the consortium. That just happens to be the total list.
Okay. Then I guess the last question I have is, do any of these school districts have, this issue came up before where there was a big savings account, and they just felt that should be separate. Has that been worked down to the point now where we don't have that savings account carry over from previous years?
It's called a fund balance, and that is one issue I particularly looked at. Because if a school district was carrying a large fund balance in 66, or 86, 88, or and in 90 they had no fund balance or negative, it's an indicator to me that they had to spend that money to keep operating for those interim years. And basically, they have gone down.
Well, they've gone down, but I mean, they spent it down to where...
We're not seeing big fund balances out there now.
Okay, we're not going to be then embarrassed where somebody says, why did this one get an extra $200,000? They got $500,000 sitting in an account that they just aren't spending at all.
I don't believe that's the case in any of the single funding community school districts. As a matter of fact, you'll find that not only is that the case, it's gone down. Alternatively, they have put in more local money, and quite frankly, their mill rate's as high as the larger districts and the more affluent districts in the state, the better tax-based districts, but they only get about 50% of the amount per pupil out of their increased tax rate. And so that is one of the issues, I think, that's created the situation as it stands now. I'm not here saying to you that the state by itself has created the situation that they exist in, but conditions have, and we're still talking about some sort of equity among expenditures on students.
Thank you. Are there further questions? Thank you very much. Senator Cotton, just a moment, gentlemen.
Senator Fisher referred to the amendment here and compared it to another number that he compared the 156 to 150. And
yeah, in the bill. The bill before us.
The Senate Bill 20 before us.
20. Well, I've got sponsored substitute for Senate Bill 20, but I don't see the number. I don't see that.
Well, here it is. And I don't have
that copy right there. It must be in here. I need a copy of the CS.
I mean, I just picked the top one.
So in that case, these are the same numbers that the governor reflects? Or?
Yes. This is within the governor. We pulled this and we just adjusted them to come out to that. The governor just had a blank figure and we spelled out the way that would be distributed. So what the amendment that we're talking about now would be, these would be adjusted upward to accommodate what they're talking about.
Now, what was the governor's point?
I think I need to make an apology to the committee. I had thought we had adopted committee substitute for the second sponsor.
I thought we did too,
but it's not, unfortunately, has not been printed. How many of you have that before you?
I don't have
the
it.
The committee substitute for the second sponsor, substitute for Senate Bill 20.
I have it.
You have it?
I don't have it.
Yeah. We'll get copies, but I'd like to stop and ask that Senator Fisher make that. I thought that we did have that action taken.
Okay. Committee substitute?
Yes.
So that means we're approving this as an amendment then?
An amendment.
No, we are not. It doesn't. This amendment that's being proposed is not included.
But his committee substitute would be approved as an amendment.
It would be the substitute for the bill that is before
right,
the
so that would be, we'd be voting yes or no on an amendment to the bill that Senator Fisher has introduced.
Yes.
And I mean, what if we're in favor of that amendment?
Well, then we wouldn't support it.
But he could have got there a different way by saying that, you know, he had yet another, a third committee, so that third sponsor substitute, right? Is that what you wanted? Is that what you want before the committee?
I just wanted to amend the original to reflect these figures. So that's why you have this, the amendment.
Oh.
Well, I'm not sure I support your substitute, so what? I'm willing to let you put that on the table, but I don't want it to reflect my support and unsupport for what you've got in the bill or what your additional language in the bill is. I'm probably confusing you.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
I'd like to bring this bill before us for consideration. That's the, and then obviously amendments to that are proper. Would you support that, Senator Cotton?
Which bill?
No.
The sub-sponsor or the committee substitute?
The committee substitute.
Well, I think that we should at least have it before us so we can see what's in it. You know, I can't say yes or no to it until we see it. You know, I think that's one of the points that Senator Cotton has presented. It's hard to support something if you don't even have it in front of you.
Well.
Madam Chair.
Senator Menard.
No, I'm getting confused.
Okay.
maybe Senator Fisher, from your second sponsor substitute to the CS, what you're saying is you took the same amount of money and then you specifically broke it down per site?
the way it would have worked out with that amount of 2.131, all this stuff underneath equals 2.131. That's all.
And you just defined it.
We took the same way that the department would have. In other words, it's not that we just sat there and played games with any of these figures. This is what the department would have broke it out as. Except instead of just leaving it 2.131, I felt the people will see where it's going.
I see.
And that's all it does. It just shows where that amount's going. Now, the people coming in now are saying they want to increase this 2.1 to 3 point something, and that's then they show the breakdown how that would occur.
I see.
Instead of just a blank figure. The governor only had the 2.131, but never
in the
bill.
Budget.
I see. Yeah, okay. In the budget.
Senator Cotton.
Explain to me once more why you're spelling it out in the legislation. If that's the same way the department would have allocated the dollars, people would have.
I think people need to see where the money's going. You throw a figure out there, 2.1, it doesn't tell anybody anything. And I think by spelling it out here, it's the same thing that the people who are coming in with an amendment now is doing.
Doesn't the administration have a formula that they would use to break it out?
I'm not sure, because Matt Cole was just saying no.
Commissioner, could you come up a moment, please?
Well, then how did you do it?
We took the same thing.
When you put a budget figure in for the additional district support.
Yes, ma'am.
You used the same figure that was used in the last fiscal year.
That's correct.
And what Senator Fisher did was to take that distribution that you used last year, incorporated it in his proposed committee substitute for sponsor substitute. If you received $2,131,200, would you distribute that in the same way you did last year?
That's an interesting question. And by way of response, I don't know how it worked through last year. What action was taken by the legislature to establish the distribution? I believe it was our assumption in putting it in there that the legislature would act regarding the distribution of that funding, where it should go. It was not our intent to make that predetermination, or in fact act on your behalf in that regard. So we didn't specifically identify that. We simply wanted the money to be there.
Mm-hmm. Senator Fisher.
Last year when House Bill 5 became law, and this was the funding bill, these were all spelled out and went through the whole process, and we were all here last year. And so the same percentage, the 2.131 broke out the same way as House Bill 5 did last year.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how those things came. And last year it was spelled out by the legislature, this is the way it goes. So there was no change here, no number was reflected that anybody would get more or less than what House Bill 5 would have done if it were before us right now.
Right.
Yeah.
Are we getting copies of the committee substitute so everyone can see what we're talking about?
Yes. That's coming. Fine. Any other questions? Fine. Thank you, Commissioner. Why don't we take 5 minutes till we have that? While we're doing that, let me hand out a statement from the Alaska School Board. I've asked one other individual to come forward and make a brief, this is in response to questions raised by the committee dealing with the TRS impact on districts. There was a change by the legislature on contributions, and it's had some untoward impacts on the various districts. And I wonder if you might identify yourself and tell us what you've just handed out here.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm Bob Stallnaker, Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. The handout that I've just provided is the introductory section, missing graphs and charts and other things, of the most recent TRS actuarial evaluation. Now, the evaluation is performed each year to provide the TRS board with information and a recommendation to set the rates for the upcoming fiscal year. The highlights of the most recent valuation explain all of the important aspects that went into determining what the rate would be, or what the proposed rate would be. In this case, its determination is that the rate should increase.
Mm-hmm.
To review this, basically it's a number of different actuarial impacts, some resulting in a upward pressure on the rate, some resulting in a down pressure on the rate. But the most important factor, and it's the discussion on the second to the last page, is, it would be the... It would be page number 3 of the handout. And that's the discussion of Chapter 97, 1990 SLA. Now, Chapter 97 was the bill which instituted the automatic post-retirement pension adjustment for the teacher's retirement system. Now, that's the pre-funded cost of living increase for retired teachers. Along with that bill, as it points out, there was several cost containment provisions that offset the increase in cost.
However, didn't go the same time.
Exactly. Yeah. With benefit increases to a system like an automatic post-retirement pension adjustment, those costs are felt immediately because they impact the people currently working and the people in the future. The cost savings, because of constitutional guarantees, can only impact people first hired after the effective date of the bill. So those cost savings will be recognized in the future, and they will have downward pressure on the rate. We found with the public employee system, which had the same language, the same type of provisions passed in 1986, the public employee system is now experiencing decreasing rates. They went through the period where the initial impact was felt, and they're now in the mode of having the rates coming down. And we have no reason to believe that the TRS won't be the same way. One other aspect, too, to bring out is that we're beginning this year in using a more precise method to determine the actuarial costing of the system and the funding of the system. And by more precise, I mean that prior to the passage of this bill in the TRS and the bill in 1986 in the PERS, the retirement systems were considered as single-tiered systems, meaning everybody, for the most part, got the same package of benefits. With the passage of these two bills, we established multiple-tiered systems. In other words, you have some employees getting one package of benefits, new employees getting a different package of benefits. The more precise method recognizes that there will be savings in the future, and for purposes of cash flow, will come backward to recognize that you don't need to collect the money predicated on everybody having the higher benefits over the next 25 years. Mm-hmm. In any event, we anticipate having the draft valuations by the middle of March for the TRS, and it should give us some indication of what the funding method will demonstrate as far as rate needs for upcoming years.
You can't tell us exactly what that impact in dollars, in total dollars, is out there. I mean, and that's not been broken down, has it, into districts or?
Madam Chair, the rate increase for FY93 is predicted to be 3.82%, I believe. Mm-hmm. I think that number, we have FY91.
Well,
So, in essence, I think the dollar amount is somewhere in the range of I believe, $15 to $17 million.
All right, let's just say it's $15 million. And that goes then to the amount the employer, which would be the school district or the municipality or however the levy works. Mm-hmm. And is that something that can be done by district? Is that a difficult thing to do? It wouldn't be, would it, just to run that number?
Well, Madam Chairman, we could certainly run the number. Mm-hmm. Predicting or based on actual salaries that we know exist.
You're used to things very, very precise, but okay. What we're trying to do is get it just a kind of a scale of impact, so you'd have to take it on some known figures, your fiscal 91 is probably the best you have.
Since it's a function of salary, certainly we could come up with numbers.
I'd like to see that, because we hear that. We're going to hear that from municipal assistants, the whole thing, about what that impact is, because it impacts the local tax dollars. So I'd appreciate it if you could just make that available, and then I can disperse it to the committee. Okay. Are there questions of Mr. Stalnaker? This is one that you will be hearing about, this issue of cost out there. Fine. Thank you very much, Bob. I'm going to, we'll go ahead and put the school district bills aside, unless there was anyone else that had testimony to give today. And I would hope we could bring these back on Friday. Is that too soon? Do you think we can get the information?
Hope so.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we have the information that the committee needs, we will bring it back on Friday. Other than that, I will not bring it back on Friday. All right?
I expect to be prepared.
I expect so. Well, we had the late testimony on the single site, and I think that does change the numbers, and we need to work through that. And if we're convinced that's the way to go, if you'll recall, last year we had Senate Bill 7, which authorized the change in the formula. And it may be that the committee, if you're persuaded by the information you have and want to make that change, I would say that we should consider introducing a committee bill that would speak to the change in the authorization or change in the formula. You know, we had done that last year to address this problem. That was stripped out of Senate Bill 7, which will, you know, it authorizes the $63,000. Since this is an appropriation bill, we can't change it there. But if we're persuaded that the single site should be changed or we should address that formula question, I would suggest that we send a bill along to finance so that they can consider that. Is that making sense?
Yeah, I don't think we ought to be afraid to consider changes to the statute.
Well, no. I mean, we had them in. The committee did adopt that last year, and we made that recommendation. It did pass the Senate, went through all of the committees up until the, you know, the final action that was taken by the Finance Committee.
There may be some other changes that we might want to consider.
Well, it might keep us here for 120 days in several special sessions, but that was not my intention.
That's one extreme. I think it's something real simple.
Oh, okay, fine. But if you do have those, I think we might want to look at that authorization. I'd be very happy to do that. Okay. We're now going to bring back with our reduced committee Senate Bill 316, but first of all, we're going to have a overview by the Department of Corrections, and I don't know who's here to lead that discussion. Ah, Deputy Commissioner, would you join us? You've had a busy year.
We have indeed.
Do you have anybody you'd like to bring up with you, Frank?
Well, we have with us Mike Stark, who's prepared to talk about the emergency release mechanism, and we also have Chris Murray, who is the consultant on our master plan.
Well, let me, once you've identified, yes, bring them both up, but the point is, and the reason that we put off the consideration of the emergency mechanism had been some questions raised by Senator Hoffman, or that is Senate Bill 215, but also wanted to see that if, with the work that you have done, that the department sees that fitting in. We've heard some, a little bit of conflicting testimony. One saying that perhaps your prison population was declining, some changes in classification, and it raised, some questions were raised as to whether the prison management bill was still needed after, in light of the changes that were going to be recommended by this plan and some things that might be happening. So that's why we have that bill back at the same time that you're here.
Madam Chairman, it has been quite a year of planning for the Department of Corrections. You have in front of you an annual report. I might start that the Commissioner Hames sends his regrets. He was double booked today and asked.
Yeah, I saw him there earlier. Soon he wasn't hiding too much.
How much time do we have so I can?
We leave him at 10 or 11 today.
11.
Pardon?
11.
Depending on the committee, I would say that at least till 10 o'clock and possibly 10:15. Okay.
And they're probably going to call me whenever they're ready on this bill.
Yeah, on your bill.
I'm good. I'm going to for a 9:30 meeting, so I'll stay as long as I can.
Yeah.
I'll try to put them on 9:45.
All right. Let's aim in between 9:45 and 10. I can certainly stay with 10.
Okay. Well, we'll have to move rather quickly. As you're aware, last year both the House and the Senate fired a volley of questions at the Department of Corrections that was, in my estimation, unprecedented, and we didn't have very many answers. Mm-hmm. We're coming back this year with, after a year of a pretty exhaustive planning, and we have some answers, and we're drawing some impressions. I thought we have had so many interesting things occurring with the department, I thought it would be well if I could walk you through our annual report. Now, the purpose for this, in previous years, the department's annual report has been prepared on a fiscal year, and it hasn't been of much benefit to the legislature. We changed that this year to an annual report based on a calendar year, so all of the information that you have in this report is current as of December 31st. It's an exhaustive work. I would encourage your staff to read it thoroughly, and it virtually covers corrections from A to Z and what we've been up to over the past year. A lot of interesting information. If that's acceptable, Madam Chairman, I can just walk you through some of the highlights.
Well, that's fine to go through, but I thought that you were going to tell us about the plan that was done and changes. That's what we had asked a presentation.
Certainly. The master plan is one part of that, and we could go right into that if you'd
like. I think this morning, since we don't have perhaps enough time to do the whole thing, it's the master plan that I believe the committee's interested in. Senator Cotton?
I agree. And the other question, again, that Senator Hoffman raised about the alternative placements.
Yeah, this had been a major issue. If you remember last year, we had people from the classification. We went through the whole process, and that had been still a major issue that Senator Hoffman brought up in connection with Senate Bill 215, whether there was any place in there for consideration of the alternative placements. And we had a great deal of discussion with Mike Stark. Mike, do you want to join us at the table? It would be fine.
It's fun.
About the whether or not bringing in the so-called soft beds would be appropriate. And it was the feeling of, I believe, Mike, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, that would not be an appropriate mechanism, that it could cause some problems in how that system worked. And I don't think you had an opportunity to talk to Senator Hoffman on it, but that issue was out there, and that's primarily at this point what we're interested in, is to get a snapshot of how it's working out there, what's happening on the classification study, and we'll, not that we won't go into those other issues, but that's our primary interest right now.
In fact, last time I testified, I had passed out part of the department's four-year plan, mm-hmm. which was really a working document. That's included in here commentary to update you on any of these. I have with me Chris Murray of Chris Murray & Associates. Chris Murray was contracted to help us with our master planning efforts, and he can talk to you about not only the department's projections on inmate population and profiles that you'll find in the back of this report. Mm-hmm. There's some very interesting demographic information and inmate profile, both in community corrections and institutions, that I think you'd be interested in. Chris, why don't I turn it over to you, and we can...
I think that's page 155 in the report. Yes. Would you identify yourself, sir, for the record?
I'm Chris Murray, Christopher Murray & Associates, consultant to the Department of Corrections for the Master Plan. I'd like to give an overview of our preliminary findings so that you have an idea of the big picture issues as we see them. First of all, as we look at the department, we're looking at a variety of issues, including the capacity of institutions and community corrections, the population projections for future demand, the classification of inmates in terms of what kinds of services they're going to be requiring, the best use of existing resources, and how those resources might be used in the most cost-effective way possible. In addition, we've been looking at special needs and special populations, by which I would also include the female offenders within the state, as well as the medically infirm, the mentally ill, and other issues affecting the management and operations of the department. So it's a lot of territory, and we can only give a real snapshot view of this.
But it's covered, is it, in this document?
This document is the annual report of the department. The final written master plan is really a document that won't be available until this spring. However, the major implications relative to legislative initiative, the department will have a good handle on here relatively soon with regard to capital initiatives and other changes that might be necessary. One of the first things that we did, which we expected to be relatively straightforward, was to look at the capacity of the department's institutions. We thought it would be straightforward because everybody has been doing this for some years, and it's something that has been agreed to in the settlement order. But as we read the fine print and looked at what was actually out in the field, to our surprise at least, we discovered that Cleary looks at the capacity of institutions much in the same way that we would as we are evaluating a system. First, in looking at the housing capacity of individual cells and housing units around the system, and then also looking at the core support of those institutions, the utility infrastructure, the food service components, the medical components, and so forth, and their ability to serve the inmate population. Indeed, Cleary does that and identifies a variety of things which affect the capacity of institutions, including inmate visiting, recreation, utility infrastructure, food service, medical care, rehabilitative and educational programs, staff to inmate ratios, and factors of that nature. In the agreement, the parties agreed at a cap to individual institutions and therefore to the department, which is nominally about 2,500, which is introduced by words that say this: the parties acknowledge that the application of the criteria, which are described in the document, would result in the capacities listed there, given present staffing, program resources, and cell dormitory and day room size. If you go back and just look at the institutions in terms of cell dormitory and day room size, there is housing capacity across the department greatly in excess of the 2,500 beds that is identified, if you will, as the operational capacity of institutions, on the order of magnitude of perhaps as many as 700 additional beds. Our reading of how Cleary is stated, and Mr. Stark is here to contradict me if he wishes, is that the definitions that are presented in Cleary define the things that you need to look at in determining the capacity of an institution. Those are not static things. If you change the ability to deliver programs, if you change the capacity of a sewage treatment plant, if you add other features and meet the criteria, then those capacities ought to be changed. The bottom line is that with the exception of facilities for women and for some special needs population, we see no need to build new housing beds within the Department of Corrections for the long foreseeable future. That does not mean that certain things do not have to be built. That does not mean that changes do not need to take place. But it means that if you spend $100,000 to build a new bed with a brand new institution, that you can get that existing capacity at a small fraction of that cost of capital expenditure by upgrading the core support of existing institutions and expanding the utilization of existing campuses. We also have looked at each of the institutions with regard to the kinds of factors that are presently limiting their utilization, the kinds of factors that Cleary identifies and that we would recommend as being important to sound correctional practices. And I'm not going to go into all of those now, but they do include such things as amount of visiting and health care and, in some cases, food service and, in some cases, utilities. It varies from campus to campus.
Yes, go ahead.
I'll ask a question on
Senator.
As you put this together, this assessment and everything, then you looked at the court case or the Cleary case and you assimilated that into your report as far as what the outcome was, and was that a large influence in driving how you came to your conclusion?
Well, to our surprise, there seemed to be a closer fit between the criteria that Cleary established and the criteria which we had proposed when we initially said how we would do this study. And I guess we were pleased to see that there is less conflict, if you will, between some of the standards that are in Cleary with regard to how you determine capacity, certainly, and sound correctional practice. So I'm not sure if I got to the heart of your question.
To a certain extent. And then the fact that the inmates have access to the courts and that process, is that we'll be seeing more of that in the future, do you expect, or do you have any?
Well, the access to courts and so forth has implications relative to the Department of Corrections and where people are housed. During any time prior to their sentence or any appeals that are involved, they need obviously to have access to the court that has jurisdiction over them, and that has, if you will, regional implications for the size of facilities, for jail-type facilities, for the pre-sentence population, and for those who have appeals, as cost implications for transport and so forth. And those are will be weighed in our evaluation of the recommended size of individual institutions and where we would be expanding and where we might actually be downsizing the existing institutions.
As a point, I think it's, you know, as we look at the big picture and planning and everything, I know, and maybe other areas have, I'm sure, but I know that when the city of Palmer put their pretrial facility together, that it was really, they took into consideration the transport and their
yes.
pretrial right across the street from the courthouse and stuff like that. And I think those kind of things, maybe in the long term, we have to look at, because it is very expensive and does drive the cost of mm-hmm. Moving, transporting prisoners and access to the system and everything else.
Well, one of the features of what one of the analyses we have not completed, but which we are including in our analysis, is a cost minimization study. As we look at the utilization of existing resources, where the arrests are occurring, what kind of arrests are occurring, and sentences are being handed out by, if you will, catchment areas or regions within the state, to identify the best use of those resources and when you should start moving people out of outlying institutions into long-term sentence facilities where you can concentrate your program and treatment resources rather than duplicating many of those services in the outlying areas, which is particularly problematic for the small female populations that occur at many of those areas. And that was a good illustration where we probably will be recommending that female offenders with sentences substantially shorter than those of males would come to a centralized facility so that the issues of program parity can be accomplished mm-hmm. in a cost-effective manner.
Senator Menard, further?
No.
Just one comment, and obviously we don't have the report before us, but we've had, I believe, a feeling that there was a great deal, I don't know if the proper word is churning, but moving of prisoners because of a feeling that we were too crowded here and we needed a bed here. And so when you come in and say that there's really a pretty extraordinary additional capacity out there, that's very surprising to me. And it makes, I guess, an obvious question is that an issue of management or is that an issue of needing adjustment in certain of the capacities within those existing facilities? I mean, 700 bed potential in addition to a system where we have heard the beds, you know, people are shuffling into beds and there's been a great deal of movement between facilities doesn't make sense to me. I mean, what's happening out there? Why is that?
Well, I think it is the latter issue having to do with having to do some things in order to increase the capacity of existing institutions.
Mm-hmm.
It's not something you can snap your fingers and say it's now different. There are, you know, significant limiting physical elements to existing institutions which have resulted in the capacities that are in the Cleary Settlement Order. Some changes need to be made in order to accomplish additional capacity. Capital changes, which, you know, take time to effect. Operational changes, which are going to take budgetary adjustments. I want to get into that particular issue in that the development concept that we are proposing for the department is basically one of trying to achieve some economies of scale where We can take certain institutions, particularly the sentence institutions, and make a few fairly larger institutions, not adding additional housing, adding some support staff, adding some supporting facilities, and the per capita cost of operating those institutions should go down as the number of inmates go up, because you do not have to add staff at the same rate as you add inmates to accomplish that. Similarly, at some of the institutions, there are, just as statewide, you have a lot of small institutions, some of which you can, you know, never live without because of the nature of the situation you have in Alaska. But at certain institutions, within institutions, you have very small management units, particularly with regard to housing. And housing units need to be staffed 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. And under the space standards that are applicable in Cleary, you should be able to use portions of existing institutions to concentrate larger numbers of inmates for housing where you have the 24-hour staffing. Vacating some of these other areas and converting those spaces to the program support, which Cleary says you have to have in order to operate at a higher capacity. So we think even at some of the smaller institutions, there may be some opportunities for economies by using the institutions themselves in different ways. If you will, closing down some housing wings, converting them to other 8-hour-a-day purposes rather than 24-hour-a-day staffed purposes, and concentrating your custody staff resources in other areas.
You have adopted the Cleary standards then as, quote, reasonable, humane, desirable, whatever the adjective might be. Is that correct?
Yes. I see no reason to depart from those. Those are well within the norm of practice elsewhere across the country. They are not either overly restrictive or overly generous.
Fine. Go ahead, please.
Okay. The next major feature that we're looking at is the population projection and the breakdown of that population by classification means. These have important implications for the future. The first has to do with the population projection, which is a projection that's been prepared by the Department of Corrections. We have reviewed that population projection and conclude that it's something that's been professionally done and is probably the best projection that you can get with the current information that's available. Having said that,
I might interject here, you'll find that at page 158 and 160.
Fine, thanks.
The graphics.
Having said that, there are superior methods for projecting inmate populations if you have the appropriate data. That data is not available, and we are making recommendations to the department to develop that kind of database and start maintaining that information in a way that will be able to provide you with population projection methodologies that are more sensitive to the kinds of policy initiatives that can happen by a legislative body such as this, changing length of stays for certain types of crimes, changing rules about parole, eligibility, and so forth, or by factors that can occur in funding of police officers in the city of Anchorage or
court system
state
or whatever.
Those kinds of things have more impact immediately on the number of folks who are incarcerated in prison than any change that you might conceive of happening in terms of the amount of crime in society. And a different methodology, which has information about numbers of arrests, locations of arrests, conviction rates by courts, length of stay information by various courts for different crime types, allows you to have a methodology that then you can test what the future may look like under different sets of policy assumptions. So the population projection, however, that we currently have, which I think is the best that is available, is really a statistical projection of what has occurred over past years. And because in the last 12, 14 months or so, population numbers have leveled off and started to decline, population forecast indicates a small decline over the next 5 years. That decline is primarily concentrated in sentenced facilities for male offenders. Works a little bit differently for female offenders, except the numbers are so small there that it probably doesn't matter.
But you're not real confident about that because of the method, right?
I would be more confident if there were better information available to develop it. I think it is the best information we can get and is reasonable information to base your planning decisions on. I also think, because of what we have found relative to the potential capacity of existing institutions, that even a reasonably substantial under forecast by this methodology is not something that's going to kill the department or the state.
Because of this additional capacity that's out there. Senator Menard.
Well, I was just going to follow up on that. And if I'm understanding, you're saying in the way this was developed that in the near future we are going to be looking at a reduction in the numbers in the facilities?
It is a small reduction, like 100 people over the next 5 years, going from nominally 2,800 to 2,700. So it's not something that is going to have a dramatic impact. It's not something that's going to change the churning that the chairman described, which is in many respects an artifact of Cleary. I mean, there are these specific rules about how long you can have people at above the capacity of different institutions. And the lack of flexibility that is within the department now is really unfortunate. It is, causing the department to do things that they wouldn't under other circumstances do. But there is a solution in the not very long term, but one that's going to take, a year or two or more to get underway. There are some pieces that have to be brought into place. The domino, I think, that's at the head of the line is to solve the issue having to do with female offenders so that we can expand capacity for male offenders within the system and be able to live within the current caps for a little while longer, while some of these other initiatives that we'll be outlining in more detail later are brought online.
Senator?
Just to follow up, it just seems like many areas are seeing a moderate to even large increase in their population coming into the district. In the Matsu area and many other areas, in just this last year, we saw an increase of like 700 students that came into the district type stuff. And I think there, Anchorage is receiving and Kenai and other areas of the state. And it just seems like with that influx, and if this is a trend that's happening and we get a more severe recession in the lower 48, things are doing better better than the lower 48. It tends, like Alaska's history, we get this influx of people that come in. Along with that, you're getting a certain segment that's coming with it that tends to be more involved in crime and various other things. And I'm just speculating on that, but it's just a feeling. Do you think that those things are happening so fast that it was not able to be incorporated in this? Because I find it... It just doesn't seem that what's happening, that there would be a reduction of I hope you're right, but it just doesn't seem like the feelings that I have are leaning that way. Now, I don't know if you have
I hope the population projection is right, too, but I think some measure of caution is advisable. And I think your example of pressures on the school population is a very good one. A different population forecasting methodology with sound data, part of which the Sentencing Commission staff is developing the base for that, is the way to go in the future. One of the things that is commonly done in population projections is to tie the projection to changes in the demographic profile, total numbers, and in certain age groups within the population. Frequently, the at-risk lead indicator is the number of males 18 to 39. So, pressure on your school system is a lead indicator, if you will, of future pressure on your correctional system. So that's a good example and a good reason why getting a better information base for population forecasting is advisable, and why there's probably some reason to look at the numbers with caution.
Senator Cotton.
I'm still interested in a couple of the aspects of the master plan and the question of alternate placement. And if I could, first on the master plan, I know last year the Department of Corrections came to us and suggested that there was a need to get started pretty quickly on additional housing for women. And it sounds like from what you've said so far, you still believe that's the case.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, so therefore, last year your proposition was that you would add to or construct another
building or whatever was required at Meadow Creek. And at least that was an impression we got. That was what you were interested in doing. Is that still the case?
Last year we had proposed that because under the Cleary Final Settlement Agreement, the department had agreed to go forward with that. That proposal was not based on a master planning effort. What the master plan will indicate with respect to female offenders, I don't know in terms of facility size or facility location.
So that's still being considered?
That will be part of this plan, that's correct.
And at what stage in the planning is that question?
Yeah, I think we have some pretty strong opinions about that right now.
I'd be interested to know what they are.
I think the approximate size is somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 beds. And the idea of having a female institution co-located with your primary sex offender treatment program is an unusual one, and not one that we would recommend continuing.
Slightly.
That the logical place for a new female offender institution is in Anchorage. We also think... let me jump ahead.
But you've got now. Does that mean that you also think we ought to take the female prisoners and change the nature of Meadow Creek now?
Well, you have to have a place to put the female offenders first. You have to have some place to put them first.
I'm trying to put this together. You say if you need more space, you ought to put it in Anchorage. But meanwhile, you've still got a female facility in Meadow Creek. So is it part of your plan to move that as well or leave that there?
To move the females out of Meadow Creek when you have another place to put them and create a male institution.
So you're saying then that the new facility that you would propose building would house all the females who are now in the system. So you'd be able to take everyone out of Meadow Creek and then move male prisoners to Meadow Creek.
Right. And all the new facility would be the booking facility for all females in the greater Anchorage area, too. And the jail facility for that area too.
You know, there was some suggestion last year by some folks that the people that lived in the surrounding area or in the community that Meadow Creek's located in weren't very happy about additional space being built there. And I don't believe that's true. I think that there's been strong support in the community that if you wanted to build another facility there, it'd be fine with us. But whether that was a factor, it doesn't sound like it was from what you said here today. But if you thought that was a factor, don't think that.
Okay. I hadn't thought it, so I won't let it in. Right.
But it's important if you do think it.
Okay. All right. Let me jump to another point. That's an important one.
Just before you go on, one thing that I have to say is I've been around for a long time, and as have the other senators here. And we have always heard about the precipice that was out there. So what you're coming in and saying, we're going to run into this horrible problem. We're going to have all these people and no place to house them, and we're really just not looking at our responsibility because it's going to come and it's going to hit us. So what you're saying is, a positive shock, but it's one where I believe we really need to see the report and we really need to work it through. Because it is so different. It's always been where we're going to have terrible shortages and costs, and it, there has to be a lot of cost in the fact that we have had to move people between facilities so frequently that you're coming forward with some information that I'm finding a little bit hard to process.
Well, Chairman, if I might, to elevate your comfort level.
The senator has a bill up in finance, and that's why we lost Senator Hoffman. But I would like to continue.
I think there are a lot of caveats to our population projections, but in real life terms, we have experienced a plateauing of the inmate population for roughly the last 18 months, and we don't see that changing. I believe Chris is going to talk about the classification validation. There are other things going on in the department that will provide some modest bed relief also.
If I can just try to get to the quick on that, do you feel that a classification study or whatever the process you're going through there is going? Have you got any early results? Are you going to suggest that in fact more people can be put in alternative placement situations or
yes not? And yes.
That's pretty quick.
It's actually not our study. There's another consultant who has completed their study on the classification validation. And I mean, we looked at the system and we said, boy, this looks overclassified to us, and the department has suspected this for some time. And basically, the department's classification system is an abundance, the current one is an abundance of caution, double counting risk factors and things in a way that is overly cautious. Projected classification breakdown with a revised classification system will result in about the same numbers of people at close to maximum custody, a significant reduction in terms of the numbers of people at medium custody, a great increase at minimum custody, and an increase in community custody. We think there should be no reason for the department not to be able to fill the current CRC beds.
One of the things that I know will come up, and I would ask on behalf of Senator Hoffman, was in the change, and this perhaps to the commissioner, of the, were there kind of some of the cultural conditions taken a look at in Senator Ferguson, or Senator Hoffman's comments regarding the native offender who may have a drinking problem, but once is away from that alcohol, could take far less restrictive confinement. Was that taken into account?
That question that was raised by Senator Hoffman a little less than a year ago has plagued me all summer.
Mm-hmm.
With the relief in the population, and for instance, the Bethel facility being largely pretrial, those empty beds and the halfway house, we simply have not filled those, and it will be taken into consideration. But I think that the question, I've thought about it a lot. I'm not so sure that the question is that the native population is easier to manage, which they are, therefore they should be in soft beds, absent a crisis. I'm not sure that we would want people with that type of offense in those number of years in that less secure environment. It seems that there's a greater question, and that is why do we have a disproportionate representation of the native community? And that's going to require more than the Department of Corrections. But I certainly intend on discussing this. And in fact, I just as an aside, when we were talking about moving the prisoners out to Oklahoma for simply cost reasons, the governor was opposed to that. And in fact, I don't know how much thinking the governor has done about corrections, but he immediately expressed concern about the native population overrepresentation and directed us to start working on that. I have nothing definitive, but we are going to fold that into our planning effort.
Mm-hmm. Since we've lost so much of our committee, I wonder if I could, let's see what we can do to pull this together. How soon are you going to have something for us to look at? And I guess I'd direct that to the department, because I assume that this is working, and right now it's a consultant. I'm sure you're working together, but whether this is, you've reached an official department recommendation, I don't know. So how soon, actually, will there be a proposal with the parts in it? Because I would assume there's going to be some information or, you know, some legislative changes, some way that you can handle the Cleary issue as you do certain other things. So what are we looking at?
Well, we have a lot more going on in the department than simply the master plan. There's the Pete Marwick efficiency evaluation. You will see some of the Marwick recommendations folded into the governor's amended budget. As Mr. Murray has said, we don't expect a final...